You call yourself a reformed ex-wellness influencer.
Like, I got to 100,000 and then I was like, let's go 200,000, 300,000. It was never enough. I was obsessed with maintaining an image of perfection.
And you were bringing in something like $300,000 a year.
Being myself and tying products into myself. When I was canceled, you can't win against those people. They just want your head.
It's about your white privilege. It's about cultural appropriation. Do you regret apologizing?
100%.
Lee Tillman, welcome to the Free Press offices. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book that comes out today, your memoir, If You Don't Like This, I Will Die, is like the first, you're calling it an influencer memoir. Mm-hmm. It's so brilliant. It's so brutal. It's arresting. Everyone is going to love reading this. And it's like, it's really everything you like wanted to know, but were too afraid to ask. Mm-hmm. I think reading your book, I noticed that it braided together this idea of wanting to be liked, wanting to be desired, and then wanting to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And you write that in your second year of high school, you developed a severe eating disorder. Mm-hmm. How did that start? And how did the internet feed into it? Mm-hmm. I'm curious.
Well, so the eating disorder started before I was even really on browsing. I think I was on AIM at the time, but I wasn't really, mostly I was actually getting magazines where I was seeing Cosmopolitan and 17 Magazine. But mostly I just remember seeing, you know, Lindsay Lohan and the Olsen mm-hmm. twins and all of these celebrities kind of shrinking before our eyes. It was like the age, you know, Britney Spears's, her hip bones were just jutting out. And again, like, I just also want to be clear that I do not blame any of these women. Like, I don't blame anyone for that eating disorder. And we can get into how people blame me for giving them an eating disorder. But I don't blame even people who had an eating disorder because they were also, I don't even want to say victims, just part of culture, right?
Yeah.
Like also, I had total free will to not look at those images, but I didn't know any better and I was looking at them.
Yeah.
And I was taking it in. And it all started because right before field hockey season, we decided to go and do who could lose 5 pounds. And we all lost 5 pounds and then I just kept going.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the difference between people who can get an eating disorder and not. It's kind of like drinking.
Yeah, it's like drinking.
Some people just take it to the extreme. Others just have no desire to. And my friends kind of all bounced back and I just kind of kept going. But also eating disorders were really chic in my town from Fairfield County, and there was a lot of girls taking Adderall, and or just like one girl was like, well, I drink 13 Diet Cokes a day and have a mango for breakfast. So it was just like,
and you're like, 13 Diet Cokes,
okay, that thin girl's eating a large apple, like, you know, just taking notes. Just that's just like how a lot of people do it. So it's like before the internet. And then later on, when I was in my early 20s, and at this point it's 2012, 2013, 2014, I'm looking at other blogs and Instagram influencers, and as I talk about in my book, I'm looking at these vegan women who are really healthy and fit and toned, and whether or not they have an eating disorder, I don't know, it's really none of my business, but because of my mindset and what I was seeking, I clung onto that, and I was like, I want to look like them, I want to be like them, I'm going to do what they're doing.
And they're giving you the blueprint.
They're giving me the blueprint.
Freely the Banana Girl. Mm-hmm. I mean, Eugenia Cooney is sort of a separate situation, but like there's a lot of these, I guess they're early health influencers, mm-hmm. and the tenor of the thing that they're doing, it seems to be about clean eating. Mm-hmm. We're not doing processed foods. We're doing OMAD one meal a day or mono meals.
Yeah.
Or talk to us about the bananas, because this is like such a like perfect, insane anecdote. And it's like, I think one of the perfect examples of like, it looks a certain way online, and then here's when the rubber meets the road, here's what it's like. So talk to me about the banana diet.
So the banana diet is called Banana Island, and it was really big in the early 2010s, and it stemmed from 80-10-10, which was 80% carbs, 10% protein, 10% fat. And which is the belief that like, you know, you just need to eat a lot of fruit and a lot of carbs. It was kind of this like vegan heavy raw community that was promoting Banana Island. And I was living in New York City at the time. I had a corporate job. And I remember looking at these girls posting their daily banana hauls and just holding bananas and being like, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And the simplicity of it was alluring. I had been in treatment years earlier, and I had kind of been drawn to the rigidity of early recovery when they say you need to eat X amount of this, X amount of that. I liked rules, I like structure, I like rigidity, and what's more, what could be more simple than just baby food, basically,
right?
Just banana, you know, banana all day, every day. And I was like, oh my God, well maybe I could look like that if I eat bananas. So I tried it for about 2 days. I think I lasted a two days, and I found it very difficult. It almost made me sick to my stomach.
I know you describe almost like gagging down these bananas. Can you eat bananas now? Did they ruin you for life?
They did for a while. I'm back on bananas, but I had to really pause on them. And I think I also overdid it to a point where like bananas made me feel really sick.
Yeah.
For a while.
I mean, it's sort of like the rule of everything in moderation. Yeah. It's like that is another theme of this book, yeah. I feel like. It's mm-hmm. like the idea of something being simpler, unprocessed, that's actually a good thing. Mm-hmm. But then when you take it to the extreme, the thing you're using to heal you becomes a sickness in and of itself.
Right.
Did you have an early sense of this is my medium and I'm really good at this?
Yeah, starting in college, my freshman year of college, I had been at my eating disorder treatment clinic my senior year of high school. And within months I was in college and I was kind of catapulted into, you know, dorm room life, but after just kind of going through a pretty traumatic, emotional, highly turbulent time in my life, and I was in recovery and I was working on getting better, but I kind of felt mismatched with the college campus life of everyone kind of drinking and going out when I had just done all this self-reflection. Not saying that like I'm, you know, one's better than the other, but I wanted to find other people who had been through what I went through, so I went online, as we all do. That's a great way to find community. I couldn't find it in the sororities. I couldn't find it, you know, on the college quad. So I went online and started blogging about my experience and being a college student in early recovery. And I found a robust group of women waiting for me there. Like they were just, they loved my work. It was called, my original blog was called For the Love of Peanut Butter, and everyone had their own blog too. And we were all supporting each other. It was such an early, innocent time.
Was it on WordPress or like?
WordPress.
It was an early WordPress.
Early WordPress, yep.
Wow. Yeah. And were you talking about what you were eating? You were mm-hmm. talking about like the social life?
I was doing one of those very kind of classic blogs, but I would post my breakfast and lunch every day and I would take a picture of it, and then I would do a little excerpt. Like today I had my AP US history exam. I'm really finding it difficult to bond with my roommate. Like I would kind of share it like a diary.
Yeah.
But people really loved that intimate look into my life. But I also would talk about, you know, I'm struggling a little bit with body image today, or gosh, I really just don't like the drinking culture on campus. I wish that like we had an oatmeal club, you know, just simple girl things, I guess, you know. I was just trying to find my community and I couldn't find it, and I was too afraid of finding it in person. I've always found it easier to communicate online. I mean, I also like to communicate in person, obviously, but I've just found it to be one of my strengths.
So you're in college and you write about women, other girls on campus discovering you online. And was that a moment of dissonance, or were you like, oh, that's cool? Or were you like, oh no, these are two separate people?
Yeah, at that point, I was spending most of my energy on my online world, and I hadn't really been investing in my IRL world, which is another theme of the book, of this like the pull and push between, you know, where to invest my time and the different identities and kind of images I'm portraying.
Yes.
And I really wanted to keep them separate, and so it wasn't that great to be discovered. I remember someone commented like, wait, are you an SJU girl? And feeling
what's
shame.
SJU?
That's the school I went to. And I just felt shame. Like, oh no, this is a very kind of, I felt and this is also how I felt writing the memoir, almost like, I'm just going to put it out there and pretend no one's going to read it. I was doing it mostly for me. And so to have it also all of a sudden infiltrate my real life and have maybe girls in my dorm suite find out that I was writing, what I was writing. And I was writing very emotional private things. I wasn't writing about them, but I was writing about maybe how I felt like I didn't fit into college mm-hmm. and just personal stuff that was helping others and granting me success, but I didn't want people around me to know I was the one writing it.
Were you already getting validation from people being like, thank you, I'm also in recovery?
Yes.
What did it feel like to get those messages?
It was intoxicating.
Yeah.
I was getting messages. My blog grew. I started the blog in September of 2008 and I closed it by April, and I had hundreds of thousands of readers in that time. I just found it very, very comforting to every morning log on, make my breakfast, post it, and then see the flood of comments come in, and it was intoxicating. And I remember I loved it, and I would get emails from younger women who hadn't gotten help yet but wanted to. I would get emails from mothers. I would I got emails every day from people, and I was like, this is my life's purpose, to help people. And I was really drawn to that, and I later replicated that in Leave from America.
You also are really open about the fact that you didn't like dream of having a regular job. That mm-hmm. wasn't like something that you wanted to, you know, go into marketing or work for a big corporation. How far ahead were you thinking at this time?
Well, after, I think like all of college, everybody would go and get internships at magazines and go to New York City for the summer. And I just, all of a sudden it would be like June and I would be like, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to go work on a farm this summer and learn about organic farming, or yeah. I'm going to go work at a raw vegan smoothie bowl place. I was just drawn to what I liked, and I never really saw the traditional career path for me. But I also was, I needed to do that. So out of college, in order to make a living and move to New York City, I took a job in marketing and events for a restaurant group in Soho. And I started another blog, Leave from America, on the side. And once that blew up, I realized that I could make money from it. And then once I made my first sponsored check for $75, it was like, I was like, okay, if I made $75 from having 8,000 followers, it was like a matcha.
Okay.
And it was before FTC had even realized that people could do sponsored posts on social media. So I did it. I think I just didn't even write that it was sponsored. Incorporated the matcha, and they paid me $75, and I was like, okay.
It's the sweetest $75
ever. The sweetest, because I was like, wow, I can do what I love and make money from it? That's so cool. I don't have to be at this job every day where my boss is really difficult. It's late nights. It was just a very inconvenient job. And I was like, what if I could make money from home cooking?
Right. Of course, though, the cost to that is collapsing mm-hmm. your identities, your person, but you're a person who's also a brand, who's also a business. Like, yeah. you're just like a soup.
Yeah.
And you talked about kind of trying on different identities or different images. We have Party Girl Lee. Mm-hmm. We have Farm to Table, sort of like, you know, peak Obama era mm-hmm. Lee. We have chakras, Ayurvedic, yeah. you know, once you move to LA, sort of the more like yoga
yeah.
thing. You yeah. have like the healthy eating, the sort of like yeah. Aussie style mm-hmm. clean girl thing. Where are you in this?
I think that I was figuring it out. I mean, I think yeah. that I was young, and some people just stay the same and don't change, and they're just kind of always themselves. And I think I was there. That was me. But I was trying to figure out who I was by diving into these. I mean, they're also all connected. They're different facets of health and wellness. And I think mm-hmm. they're all spurred from my early experience in treatment. Because I think that, like, all of a sudden at 17, getting plucked out of school and being put into treatment made me look at myself, and it forced me to pay attention to my body and taking care of myself. And so I tried to positively turn that into an identity, not necessarily rooted in recovery, but rooted in taking care of myself. And these were just kind of the images that I saw of other people. So I was like, okay, I can do that. And I remember living in New York, as I write in the book, at 23, 24, and moving to LA, all my New York clothes were black, and I threw them all away, and I bought all white clothes because I noticed that everyone in LA was wearing white. Mm. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna just be like, wear white and look the part. And I think I did a really good job. I think a lot of people kind of thought I was from LA, even though I'm from Connecticut.
Did you have a sense, like, I think a lot of people around our age don't put that online, it's there forever, the internet is forever, and that's sort of, it can be scary, it can also be liberating. Were you thinking about that, where it's like, you know, oh my God, these party pictures are gonna last forever? Like, or were you just like, I'm a public person, and you just had to accept that early?
Well, because I was the thing that made money, I was not ashamed of the party pictures I had posted earlier, because that was part of my story. Hey, look, guys, I used to be a party girl, and now I'm making nut milk with a strainer, and I'm teaching you guys how to make cauliflower smoothie bowls. And so many women related to that. I viewed it as, okay, my followers all have the corporate jobs, and my job is to educate and entertain them. Mm. I don't need to be perfect. It's better if you're not. Yeah, exactly. I was relatable in that way, because I was sharing those parts of myself that a lot of people wouldn't.
Right. And they're, I mean, now when I talk to people in Gen Z, they're just so blasé about something like, you know, privacy. It mm-hmm. just like doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you had a sense early on? And reading the book, it feels like that, that you're like, don't value privacy that much. I don't know how else to ask that.
The best way I can describe it is when I was growing my Instagram following and really starting to find success in my influencer career and starting to make serious money,
yeah.
was you have to shut off that part of your brain. And it's a very natural part of your brain. What are people going to think? Oh, should I not share this? I started to look at other influencers who were doing well, and they had successfully shut down that, oh, is this cringe? Mm-hmm. Ooh, should I share this? I can't. You gotta really push against that muscle. And the more you do that, the more success you can find. Later on, I would realize that the more you do that, the deeper you're getting. And the once you share, you can't unshare. It's not necessarily a good thing to bypass that protective instinct our brain has to protect. But you can certainly find a lot of fast, cheap success that way.
This leads me to my next question, which is about relationships. Mm-hmm. You write about a fling you had in LA. And this is when you were sort of getting into yoga, it sounds like, getting free trips, you know, to Northern California and posting. And it was really funny. You had this anecdote about, like, we were all laughing and together, you know, smiling for the picture. And then the picture would be done and be like, okay, like, when we gotta be able to check into the room. You write of a fling you had in LA. You wrote, he wasn't interested in me. He was interested in the online version of me. At this point, I was still aware that those were two separate things. When do you mm-hmm. feel like you lost touch that those were two separate things?
I would say when I was about a year or two later, when I just kind of fell deeper and deeper down this hole where all of these kind of markers of groundedness had left me, of relationships and friends, and I'm saying no to hangouts, and I was just letting my work and my followers and my page take precedence over everything. And when you do that, when you put all your eggs in one basket, it's a huge risk, because if something goes wrong, like when I was canceled, your entire world collapses. So I think it was around that time where I was so alone in, I was so hyper focused on success mm-hmm. and getting to a million. Like, I got to 100,000 and then I was like, Let's go 200,000, 300,000. Mm-hmm. It was never enough, because that's just what humans are like when they see numbers. But I think that by the time I was canceled, I was like, I was already so far gone by that point that, and by that I mean, I was like, I think I used to control the narrative, and now I think that my followers were controlling me.
Talk to me about a day in a life during this time. Like, it sounds like 3 or 4 years into your time in LA before the cancellation, which we're going to get to, Lee from America would wake up in mm-hmm. her house where brands had given her everything around her, including mm-hmm. her cosmetics and her towels and her sheets.
The rug I walked on.
What would happen next?
So I'd wake up around 4:30 or 5.
Because in the morning? Believed,
yes.
Okay.
I believed that if you woke up before the sun rose, then you would have a lot of this is rooted in Ayurvedic practices mm. that many cultures practice. And I had absorbed so much of that. So I believed that if you woke up earlier, before the sun rose, that you would have a clear day. But if you woke up once the sun was like above the horizon, that you'd have a groggy day. And of course, the goal was, you know, I was obsessed with perfection, which hopefully the book makes clear, but I was obsessed with maintaining an image of perfection. But even if I wasn't posting about the perfection, I needed everything to be perfect. So I would be upset with myself if I woke up at like 6. That was late for me. Lazy. Mm-hmm. I'd be groggy and the day would be ruined. So I would wake up at 4:30, keep it early, and have a hot cup of filtered charcoal water with lemon, you know, no tap. Organic lemon, of course, like hopefully hyper local. And then I would sit and meditate for 45 minutes to an hour.
Wow.
And then I would go to the gym or go on a hike and meditate even more while kind of on this hike or doing my workout. And then I would come home and make a matcha with mm-hmm. collagen and 15 different adaptogens and start filming.
Adaptogens meaning like powders, yeah, and powders, supplements.
Yeah, herbal, okay. Herbal powders.
And have you taken pictures at this point yet in the day?
I'd usually started to record myself during the workout because my followers loved to see my morning routine because it really inspired them, because they'd wake up at 8 and they'd think, wow, she already hiked to the top of Runyon and back.
Yeah.
Okay, I can do that too. It was very inspiring. I was getting messages like that all the time. And I loved kind of sharing my journey. So I would keep them pre-saved, and then I would start uploading them during the matcha. And then that would be the kind of the beginning of the content day. And then I would have my matcha, and then I would hop onto stories and talk to my audience. And then I would make a smoothie bowl, mm-hmm. or a paleo avocado salmon poached egg toast. Yeah, it's making my mouth water thinking about those foods. They were so good. And then I would, you know, photograph that. And by that time it was 12 or 1 because everything was staged. It wasn't kind of like a messily, you know, everything was presented.
Yeah.
300 pictures taken of salmon avocado toast, and then I'd have to pick the best one and edit it.
Sure. And you're taking it from above. Yep. And
above, side, all the angles.
And so it's midday, and it's just you and your phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't talked to a single person.
Yeah.
For many, many of those months and weeks, the only person I would actually talk to in real life was the person at the gym, at the Equinox, who I would like, mm-hmm. just like, swipe my card and keep going. I would not talk to people, and I would be so exhausted at the end of the day feeling like I had talked to people because I had answered, you know, 300, 400 DMs.
Right.
And so it was simultaneously exhausting and extremely isolating because I was like, God, I can't see anyone. Like, you know, I'd run into a friend at the farmer's market and I'd be like, wow, that was exhausting because I was so tired from my job, which required me to be so social yet so antisocial.
You were like performing this girl called Lee from America, mm-hmm. and you talk about, it's like I had my Instagram voice. It was mm-hmm. a little louder. Mm-hmm. It was a little perkier.
Yeah.
Would you have like, did Lee from America have like a certain face? Like,
I don't know if she had a certain face, but she certainly spoke like very kind of, perky and happy and excited. And that's just how I naturally was. Like, I didn't ever learn to do that. It's never like I took acting classes or anything, but I sometimes would get messages from people being like, why are you screaming at the camera, yelling, and I think I was just so excited. I loved it.
And you didn't have a sense at this time like this is a little odd, or was it?
I think I was like, this is so cool. Like, this is so cool. Like, I'm making way more than my friends are. I'm being paid to be healthy. I get to create my own schedule.
Right.
I bought myself an Audi. Like, I was like, this is amazing.
And people are telling me I'm gorgeous. I inspire them. Yeah. I want the cookbook or whatever it is.
When's the cookbook coming out? Workshops were selling out left and right. Everything I kind of sold, people bought. And I was just getting inundated with partnerships where I had to start like turning brands down. So
tell
me, signs.
How would that work? Tell me about the brand partnerships. You would reach out to them. They'd reach out to you.
No, they would reach out to me. I think in the beginning I started reaching out to brands, but I got to a point where I was doing so well that we were turning down brands left and right.
And what's our follower count at this point, do you think?
200,000-300,000.
Okay. But they're engaged.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you were bringing in something like $300,000 a year at this point, mm-hmm. doing that.
Yeah.
Being yourself.
Being myself and tying products into myself.
Right. Whether it's, list some of the products that you would sell.
Collagen.
Yeah.
Workout gear.
Yeah, Outdoor Voices. This mm-hmm. was like early days of Outdoor Voices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Adidas, Vital Proteins, collagen, supplements.
Blenders.
Vitamix. I think, what's it called? I did like Simple Mills grain-free pizza crusts.
Wow.
Mm.
And were you thinking at this point, were you like, I'm a celebrity? Like, I may not be on a TV show, but I'm a celebrity.
Well, like in terms of getting recognized in person.
Yeah, what was that like? Did that happen a lot?
That happened a lot, yeah. Especially in specific places. Like, it's not like it would happen like, you know, all the time, like certain celebrities like Jennifer Aniston leaving the house. But it would happen where if I was going to basically anywhere in LA or New York, that it would happen, especially like in the West Village or in Echo Park or Hollywood. Like if I was going into a smoothie shop or Alfred's or, you know, Melrose Place or
Target rich environments.
Yes, 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 yes.
I love this. Before we get to the cancellation, which I was canceled when I was 17, and I was like, it's such a physical experience. People mm-hmm. don't talk about like the physical sensations of it, and you mm-hmm. captured it so beautifully. Mm-hmm. But the workshop sort of came about because a relationship that you were in ended, mm-hmm. And you decided to, you said, I wanted to work on work, mm-hmm. which I love that. The relationship that you describe, and that's sort of like the bulk, the relationship you're in during the bulk of the book, is with someone who followed you online, mm-hmm. a fan. Mm-hmm. Was that an animating thing as part of it? Or is that just sort of like, well, you meet on Hinge, or, you know, you meet on Instagram? Like,
yeah, I think that it inherently set up a dynamic that, looking back, in the moment, it was like natural.
Yeah.
But there was kind of a weird, looking back, there was kind of this weird like, wow, he really just kind of found me years before we met and had already had these preconceived ideas about me. And there was kind of this inherent power dynamic that made it so that it was difficult to looking. I just don't think you meet on similar playing fields when you're collecting all this information about someone before they have the chance to collect information about you. Oh. When you're meeting someone with dating, right? You want to kind of meet on even playing field.
Yeah.
And it was like he had these ideas. He kind of already knew me.
Yeah.
When he met me and was like, my friends never thought you would actually meet up with me. All of his friends knew me. And it was like,
you were like a dream girl.
I was a dream girl. Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, it's funny because in my head, I'm like, yeah, the power dynamic of you being so much more powerful than him. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you thought about it in a different way, because I'm like, you're Lee from America. Mm-hmm. Like, you are this, you know, important, raking in money, like, entity. Mm-hmm. Which is yes. another way to look at it, I guess.
Yes. But I think that it's kind of sad. Like, that's not the kind of relationship that I want to be in, where it's like, I am this, like, kind of the way that you're describing, and I think that the way that it's written in the book, and it probably is that I was like a person, but first I was always kind of the first image he had of me. It was like the smoothie bowl influencer.
Yeah. I love that. And when things were happening in your personal life, or maybe in that relationship, would you think, like, as they were happening, like, this is how I'm going to package it for online? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just how my brain was working at the time. What's happening in the moment as it's happening, I'm already imagining images. Mm-hmm. This is pre-video, so pre-reel and TikTok, but I think any good influencer thinks that way. You have to. You just start thinking content, 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 content. You get into a flow.
And this is like kind of pre-algorithm.
Yeah.
This is pre-for you page. This is like sort of like when hashtags were big. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like discoverability, mm-hmm. I guess you could say.
Yep.
Okay, so talk to me about the workshop. Mm-hmm. What would Lee for America offer during a workshop, and how did they come about?
They came about because they were a great way to meet my community in real life. Mm-hmm. I was always talking into the void, as I used to describe. Like, I was just on my phone talking to my camera. And I mean, I would have moments of like, this is weird. Like, I'm mm-hmm. talking all day. My voice would be tired. And I hadn't seen a single person, like I said before. And so my workshops were a time for me to be like, oh, yeah, there are people behind these screens. Someone asked me, like, what was it like to kind of upload a story and have 100,000 people watching it? It's hard to, like, imagine that. Like, you know, I know that that's, like, a stadium size. But it's also kind of like, is it? Are they bots? Is it real?
Right.
Is any of this real? Like, you're so disconnected from it. And you kind of have to be. You can't upload a story and then think, oh, my God, 100,000 people are going to, you know, you just got to be
you'd be so overwhelmed.
Yeah, exactly. So you just got to kind of cut that off. So my workshops were a way for me to be like, this is real. This is legit. I mean, I would, like, cry at the end of my workshops. My audience and followers would cry meeting me. It was a very emotional experience. We were in a parasocial relationship together, after all.
Yeah.
But my workshops were not only a way for me to bring in a little income, but they were a way for me to connect with my audience. And I love them. I really love doing in-person things. I always have. And I decided to raise my prices because my workshops were always selling out fast, within hours. And I thought, okay, the demand's there. Let's raise them a little bit. Let's up-level this.
And the workshop, it's you rent out an event space, they mm-hmm. come, you guys mm-hmm. have lunch together, you do a demo for a smoothie bowl.
Demo meal, demo drink, kind of a presentation.
Yeah.
And then a Q&A, audience Q&A, where we can just chat.
Okay, I love this. Yeah. And it's to meet you and for you to meet them and for them mm-hmm. to meet each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is the price of this workshop that you decide to do?
So I decided to raise the prices from maybe when I first started off at doing the workshops, they were $75. And then we gradually increase them. And then I decided to do a tour in San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. And I raised the prices to about $500 to $750. $500 was just GA. Mm-hmm. And then $750 was included both the price of the workshop with a VIP add-on of a better gift bag and then dinner with me after. So in total, you're getting like 6 hours of time. And during the workshop, so eventually, you know, I was canceled. But all those VIP tickets sold out right away because people were like, $750 to hang out with my iconic smoothie bowl queen?
Yeah.
Easy peasy.
Internet best friend.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really so weird to say like it was a different time, but it was. Mm. What year was this?
This was 2018.
Okay, 2018. Wow, pre-COVID. This is like things are really like kind of heating up. Mm-hmm. So you announce the prices, the tickets sell out, and then what happens?
Well, the VIP tickets sold out and the GA tickets are going steadily.
Okay.
But then within like 30, 40 minutes, the negative comments start coming in.
Yeah.
And we were kind of expecting, my team and I were kind of expecting a little pushback because, you know, you see sticker shock sometimes and $500,
it's a lot of money.
It's not for everybody. And I always knew that. And it was never meant to be for everybody. But given that all of my content was free, this was pre-Substack, so there was no paywall.
Right.
It was all free on Instagram. And I gave years and years of free content. And all of a sudden, people are calling it ludicrous freelancer capitalism.
Wow.
White privilege.
Yep.
How dare you? Who do you think you are? I thought you were a good person. I thought you were all about inclusivity. And it was just echoing a similar conversation that was already happening at the time. Accessibility, wellness, Goop, all of these kind of, you know, the $600 skin dry brush that I think might be Gwyneth Paltrow used, or the crystal inside of her, the yoni egg, and all of these kind of crazy cuckoo things that started off probably being very accessible, but she brought it to luxury.
Right.
And I think that I was just more approachable than Gwyneth because I was just like a girl, 26-year-old, 27-year-old girl.
Right.
So they're like, let's go after her.
And it dovetailed too. It was like the perfect storm. It was like, it was about accessibility. It's about your white privilege. It's about cultural appropriation because you didn't grow up as an indigenous practicer of Ayurvedic principles, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of like, you know, you're a young woman. You live in LA. Who do you think you are? I mean, it was like really the perfect storm.
Perfect storm.
And you disable the comments. Mm-hmm. And this is like when it becomes like a farce. Like, I don't mean to laugh at it because like people always say with getting canceled, at least to me, it's like being seasick. Everyone else thinks it's hilarious. You think you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And it is. It is a social death in a way.
It's a social death, absolutely.
It's so overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's also freeing, which I think we're going to get to, or I want to get to it. Mm-hmm. You disable the comments and immediately you're accused of silencing people of color.
Mm-hmm. And yes, also Trump was in power, and at the time he was being accused of silencing and censoring, and so people were calling me Trump. I mean, it was wild. People were like, you are silencing people of color because I turned the comments off. So then people were going into my other things. It was
like
just
other posts
being like, when are you going to turn back comments? It was kind of just like a bloodbath.
And your parents are commenting sort of like, we love you, Lee.
We love you, supporting you from afar. I'm getting texts left and right from people I hadn't spoken to in 20 years saying, whoa, are you okay? And I was kind of like, this is kind of sordid. Why are you reaching out to me when, like, do you actually care? I felt like a lot of these people didn't actually care. They were just taking a little bit of joy and what is it called?
Schadenfreude. Well, there's an element too of just like, it's such a foreign idea to be canceled online that people don't really know how to react to it. Mm-hmm. So they'll say things like, oh my God, you're that girl. My friend hates you. Mm-hmm. And it's a little like, thank you. Like there's like, it's so awkward and uncomfortable for like everyone involved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you decide to apologize after deliberating with your team. Everyone's telling you to apologize. And you post this picture holding, you tell me.
So yes, an apology was people were like, you know, demanding accountability, demanding an apology, demanding I don't even know what, but they were just mad.
They wanted a head.
They wanted a head. Like oftentimes accountability, I call it like a just they want control. They just want you to feel bad.
Yeah.
And no amount of apology or accountability, whatever that means, will appease them. They just want your head. So I uploaded a photo of me looking really cute, holding some poppies. And I decided to, because of the backlash, offer some tickets for free to people of color, to people who didn't make enough money and wanted to attend these workshops. And I was offering, I think, 2 or 3 tickets per city. And so I posted the photo and said, you know, I'm doing a scholarship. I've listened to you guys. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And I got canceled again because poppies, which is, it's still to be decided whether or not this is actually true. But a lot of people are under the belief that picking wildflower poppies is illegal. It was funny, while we were working on the book, the fact checker for Simon Schuster was like, no, it's not. Really not illegal. But again, they want your head. Anything that they can find. And as I write in the book, people were writing, does anyone know Lee from Connecticut? What is she really like? They were just searching for dirt left and right. And that's like, you know, that's the time where people go back and look at your Twitter for something that you tweeted in 2014.
Right.
That's when that happens. But
did that happen?
No.
Okay.
No.
But yeah, that is like kind of that. Mm-hmm. You know, you see it on like the characters of Love Island I'm thinking about. But it's someone commented like, you know, it was almost
we're alerting the authorities.
Yeah.
Someone will be at your door shortly. These California poppies belong on the ground.
It was almost like they were about to be like reading you the Miranda rights. Like, you have the right to remain silent. Yeah. Like a lawyer can will be provided for you if you can't provide one for yourself. And it was sort of like, whoa, guys. Yeah, like, and you had taken the picture weeks before, I assume.
Months before.
It's so like crazy.
It's crazy.
It's really like one of my favorite parts of the book. And when people were saying like, you're crying white tears, your privilege is showing, whatever it was, were you taking it to heart or were you like, this just needs to go away? Like, what was going through your head?
I mean, I think describing the cancellation as a bodily experience is really good. And oftentimes when we are in a traumatic period in our lives and living through trauma, which is what cancellation is at its core. It's kind of saying you don't belong to humanity. We want you off, whether it's like fired off this earth, off our community. You're no longer belonging, and we all have the inherent need to be belong.
Right.
So I was already in a traumatic space, so I wasn't really able to like even register. But of course, I was panicking because I didn't want to do anything wrong, and I didn't even know what white tears were. And I was like, oh no, everything I do right now is just making this worse. If I talk about it, I get accused of something else. And if I don't talk about it, because I tried to change the subject and just post avocado toast, and everyone's like, LOL, you posting avocado toast when you're being accused of white privilege. And I was just like, okay. I mean, I don't think I realized it at the time, but looking back, you can't win against those people. They don't have your best intentions or your inner peace. They don't care for that. So there was no way of winning or even fighting with them, and I should have never engaged with them.
Do you regret apologizing?
100%.
Yeah.
That is the only thing that I regret. I regret apologizing. I regret shrinking. I regret that entire process. I do not regret anything else about that. I feel so bad for my old self.
Yeah.
And I would totally do it differently.
Well, when you're saying like, we decided to raise the prices, I'm like, yeah, of course you did. Like,
do we not understand like the like free economy? Like, did you like,
yeah, it's also people were gonna pay it.
Right. Like this is, I was engaging in business. Did you think that? I think a lot of times people want women to just do things out of the good of their heart.
Yeah.
We think of philanthropy, we think of donation. You shouldn't be taking. You should be giving. Giving, giving, giving as a woman. You should not be taking. I mean, a man would, let's face it, never have faced any question about his price raisings. He would just raise them. Like I saw with the tariffs earlier this year, a lot of brands run by men just raise their prices. And then female brands around makeup would do these big, long apologies of why they had to raise their prices, and transparency. And so sorry. Like all the makeup brands were apologizing because they were for women. And we're emotional, and we need empathy, but I think to some extent it's crazy. Women can engage in business. It's okay for women to make money, and I think that there's still a discomfort when we see women making money in public.
Right, and I think too, a system that encourages you not to have customers but to have followers, not to encourage someone to buy something but influencing them.
Yeah.
It sort of
creates
weird incentives where people expect things from you, like for you to be their mother or their friend or provide things for free because I thought we were friends.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And I still, one more thing. I still see influencers. I see influencers, a lot of female influencers, when they do a sponsored post or a link, an ad, they'll say, click the link if you want. No yeah. pressure. But if you want, I do make a little bit of money and it really helps with the fit. It's like, oh my God, you sound like you're panhandling. Just
yeah, yeah.
own it. Like, yes, you need to make money. You should be paid. I don't understand this dancing around the bush.
Well, it's also this idea of like, you don't need to click it. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, yeah, yeah, you don't yeah. need to go to the workshop. You don't need right. to buy the makeup yeah. if you can't afford it or if you don't want to. Like,
move on. Use your discretion.
Yeah, use We've your discretion. Lost that. I want to read another section that you wrote that I thought was really resonant. You wrote, I wasn't particularly political, but everyone else was posting about it, so I thought I should too. When women marched on Washington wearing pink pussy hats, I posted multiple emojis with different shades of skin, exhibiting my openness to diversity. I thought I understood what it meant, and I felt empowered for posting it. But there was also a pressure to. Everybody else was. If I didn't, I feared the omission might be recognized by my followers and turn them off. Say more about that last part, the omission. Mm-hmm. It's like, if I don't do this, they're going to notice. Mm-hmm.
Because there were other influencers who had kind of told me behind, you know, not to their followers, but who I was friends with, who were like, I'm not political. I don't like politics.
Yeah.
I'm 27. I like CrossFit, smoothies, mm-hmm. the beach, and my husband. I'm not engaged in politics. No matter how you feel about that, that was their decision. And so they decided to keep politics off their page. And they would get comments from their followers being like, you know, why aren't you? This is kind of before the snark pages, but I would see comments saying, you know, we really like you're silent on today's, you know, march, you know, why are you not supporting women? And so I saw how that omission was for that particular blogger. I didn't want those comments. I wanted to support women. Sure, that sounds great. Like, I do. And I was like, okay, I want to be on the right side of history. So I'm going to, and also everybody was doing it. Like, you go on stories and every brand is posting MLK Day, 30% off leggings. Like,
oh my God.
Like, mattress totally. Day, go buy a car, you know, or MLK Day, go buy a mattress. It's so funny how we think also that posting makes any difference.
Or you could like buy your way out of it a little right. bit. You know what right. I mean? It's like, yeah. well, 10% of this smoothie went to BLM.
Yeah.
Exactly. So like, I'm like, yeah. it's sort of like, I'll give you an out. Mm-hmm. You'll be a good person. Just post this black square. Yeah. Just use this code and then we're good.
Right. It's almost kind of like, I'm a good person, guys. I'm a good person. Here's my fist.
Yeah.
I'm fighting for that. And it was, but it was like, people were like, thank you. They like that. It's like pat on the back.
Good girl.
Yeah.
Did getting canceled change your politics?
Yeah, it changed the way that I look at the left
yeah.
and the mob mentality mm-hmm. because oftentimes it's coming from that group. And it changed the way that I engage with those people, but it certainly changed the way that I whenever I see people posting politics or activism or that extreme left that yeah. I was a part of, that the people that kind of were you know, demanding accountability and whatever that they were demanding, I realized that. And after, actually, it drew me further into the left and drew me further into that far left, because I was like, wow, I really kind of was wrong.
I was called in.
I was reading all the books, you know, and then I was realizing that there was a lot of anger and hate on that side, and it was really extreme, and I didn't want to be so extreme in any of my life.
Yeah.
So it, in that way, it changed me.
Yeah, it's almost like this obsession with purity.
Yeah.
In the smoothie bowl, in the politics. It's like, yeah. at a certain point, it's like you cannot refine it anymore. It's like, and then you get eaten by your own.
Yeah.
Did you ever cancel anyone? Did you ever participate in a cancellation?
That's a really good question. No, I don't think so. No, and especially since getting canceled in 2018, I now, no matter what the woman does, Whether it's to my friends or I write about it on my Substack or I post about it on Instagram, I often just go to the woman's support. And oftentimes I reach out to them on a personal level and just say, hey, I see what's happening. I've been through this. I'm here for you. And I've talked to many women who have been canceled and will kind of commiserate.
Really?
Because I think it's so important to do that. I mean, you know what it's like to be canceled. Nobody deserves that. Right. Nobody deserves that. Like, every sinner has a future and every saint has a past. Mm. That's what I believe. That, like, the mob of purity and moral purism, I would just love to see if their lives have been perfect this whole time. And that, like, I think it's just really all about control and power.
Yeah.
And feeling good about yourself. And I just know what it's like. And I just think it's such a terrible feeling that I don't want people to feel. So I often kind of go to the woman's defense.
Do you, you're like, I don't care what she did. She's fine.
Yeah.
Do you feel liberated by it in any way?
100%.
I know I do, but I'm curious what you think.
I love that. I think it's every person's worst fear. I think that there's something that I've been talking to Lucy about, which is cancellation, OCD, and anxiety. And as I've been talking about this book, I've been talking a lot about my cancellation, and I get messages from people saying, I've since deleted Twitter. I'm messaging you from a fake account. I don't post anymore. I have like a normal job, husband, three kids, and I'm awake at night worried about what a tweet from 2012 or a Halloween costume. And it's that fear is something new that we need to kind of be aware of, and it certainly needs to be studied. But this anxiety that I had the years after being canceled, of making the wrong move and being hated and so forth, but now that I've been through that, I don't think once you go through that, you can't, nothing scares you, because, and I think this is why I've been able to write this book, because I went through that. If I was afraid of being canceled, I never would have written this book. And if so, I would have been dishonest and left stuff out. Because this book, I left no stone unturned, and I kept everything in. And if I was afraid of being canceled or hurting someone's feelings or ostracizing someone, I would have probably not written it.
Right. You're like, it's all been said before.
It's all been said. And once you've been canceled, you realize that it's not actually real and you don't have to listen.
Right.
And you don't have to appease anyone. You're not for everybody.
No. Okay. It does invite like a certain level of paranoia, though, that this woman who's like up in bed at night is thinking about. And like almost this narcissism. Like I'll even, people are so afraid of being canceled. I'll talk to friends who are like, oh, well, do you think I posted this, but do you think it's going to be taken the wrong way? And is someone going to screenshot it? I'm like, screenshot it? You're not the president.
Yeah.
It's like this sense that like normal people are being scrutinized. I mean, you are a famous person in a lot of ways, so it may be different. But I think it trickles down even to like people with private Instagram pages.
100%. I think like everybody is afraid on some level of getting canceled, because like it goes to the core of what we need as humans, which is community.
You don't delete Instagram after your cancellation. It's sort of, I think, well, it's sort of maybe the start, or you're in the midst of this, what sounds like almost like a rolling panic attack. And you keep posting. You write that after a dinner, you get in a car and you look at Instagram, you saw that a selfie only had 25,000 likes, which I think to anyone else would be like, oh my God, I'm viral. And you're incredibly disappointed. You get a dog kind of randomly. You go to Japan with your mom. How would you describe that period now? Was it a breakdown?
No, that's like post-traumatic stress, just chugging through, because lots of my content was health and wellness, but it was also very, I was also always talking about, you know, I was 28 and a woman, so I was talking about feminism, and I was talking about being in your power and using your voice and being confident and self-assured. And I was inspiring women every month with my monthly intentions to be more grounded. And so I remember thinking to myself, how would Lee from America handle this? Of course I wanted to hide under a rock and just shut it all down. But I was like, I can't. I have to keep the image of the girl boss going. Like I have to keep going. And that made me...
Like Lee from America would get up. She would go to her Equinox class.
She would go to her matcha. Yeah, she would make her matcha and she would keep it going. But she would do it softly and gently and, you know, tiptoe. But she would keep going. And so I just had to keep going. I didn't think that there was an option to walk away.
Oh my God. And then what was the moment where you're like, them's the breaks. Like we gotta rein it in here a little bit.
I think when the apartment was flooded. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of, I think, a sign from God to just be like, okay, you need to walk away now. This is real. I'm gonna remove your apartment so that you have nowhere to live, and so that you and your puppy are gonna be forced to f- find, to restart and start over. And it was the perfect kind of excuse for me to say, I need to take a couple weeks off. I didn't know how much time I was going to take off, but that flood, I was already at my wit's end. I had already burnt the candle at both ends. I was not functioning well.
Yeah.
And that was kind of just the last straw where I was like, all right, I surrender.
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
And do you feel like God like wiped Lee from America, like off the face of the earth almost? Because I think what people don't understand, but they will when they read the book, the whole, and you describe this, actually, I'm gonna read you what you wrote. There's a flood in your house in LA, mm-hmm. your apartment, and you were looking around and you write, these were all props I'd been using, like an actor on a Broadway stage. But for me, the play was never over. It had been running practically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for years. Now I realized it wasn't just all this stuff that was props. I was a prop too. Yeah. A disposable, soulless, increasingly emaciated mannequin used by companies to sell more stuff. Do you have that realization in your dripping wet apartment with your waterlogged computer?
Yes, I do. I love that line, and like reading it makes me like relive that all over again. But one thing about influencing that's so funny is that you think, I'm in control, I'm making all this money. And then you realize, oh no, I'm just a prop for companies to make more money off of me. I think I'm in control here, but I'm not.
Right, you like saw it from 10,000 feet in the
air. I was like, okay, I did not buy any of these products. The shoes on my feet, the leggings on my pants, the coat I'm wearing. This was all bought with a code to help a company during their Memorial Day sale. I was like, what is this all for? I was all doing this to try to find health and happiness and fulfillment. And I realized that I was just like engaging in extreme consumerism.
Right.
And again, like, fine. If some people want to do that, that brings them joy, right? Like the organizers on TikTok that are buying 15 Stanley cups, that brings them joy. It's not harming me. It's
right.
They have the ability and the freedom to do that. But I was like, I've lost my way. This is not really what I thought it was. I thought that this would bring me happiness, and I'm lost.
And it's also just this sense of like, I didn't choose any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And part of being an adult is choosing.
Right. And I got so many things for free, but I kind of joked that everything is in like dusty mauve and dove gray and neutral oatmeal, because those were all the colors of the season. I actually don't like mauve. I don't like purple. I don't like pink. I really like blues and whites. And I just, I looked around and I was like, I don't even know what my style is.
Right.
Like everything was athletic at leisure and this and that and sets and hoodies and, you know, bubbles and like everything of 2018. And now it's kind of like everything is very like celebrity makeup, whatever.
Totally.
And boo-boos and makeup cases and whatever. There's kind of an aesthetic for every period. But I realized that, okay, I'm just participating, and I thought I was in control of this, but I'm actually not.
You mentioned earlier that people will reach out to you and be like, you gave me an eating disorder, which I think is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You can't, that it's like not contagious like that. Mm-hmm. But did you have a sense of like, oh my God, I'm creating a perfect image that maybe some other 15-year-old is like, oh my God, I want to be just like Lee from America, and it wasn't totally true?
Not during the flood. Like not at the last moment where I was like, I mean at that point when I was like in that particular scenario, things were so dark for me. I couldn't really see past my nose, and I just needed, it was at that point like self-preservation, put your oxygen mask on first. But I think later on I was like, oh yeah. And I've gotten messages recently being like, you know, I tried to copy your life, and I'm so glad that you got out of that and that I got out of that. And now a lot of my followers have been on this journey with me of realizing how unhealthy it can be to follow someone so deeply and think that, you know, you're best friends with them even though they don't know who you are, and to, you know, buy everything they're selling and not use kind of your own discernment, and to be in a parasocial relationship with someone online.
Right. It's like a mini cult. Mm-hmm. Or like a low-grade cult, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you decide after this flood, we're rounding third here, Lee, to take a hiatus. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that decision and why getting a bad haircut was important to it.
The decision to take the hiatus was once the flood happened, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Samson was just a couple weeks old, maybe a month or two old, and I was nervous for him that he had like lost his home too. and he was all wet from the flood. And I was like, I just want to keep him safe. Like, all I wanted was Samson and my passport. And that's like all I put in my laptop in the car. And once we got into an Airbnb, I was like, okay, I'm going to go on Instagram and log off. And that first morning, fully off Instagram, not making my matcha. I mean, not only did I not have, you know, matcha, and I didn't have any of my adaptogens, and I didn't have my blender, but I had thrown all that stuff away and left it on the curb as I write about my book. But I had such a moment of joy. There was not a single cell in my body that missed the posting. I was like, oh, this is the first, I think I maybe got a matcha at a coffee shop in Silver Lake, and I was like, oh, this is the first matcha that I'm drinking for me. I mean, it was like, it was kind of like imagine kind of weeks of dark storminess and then just like waking up to this vivid Sound of Music hill in the Alps with the sun shining and wildflowers everywhere. Right,
like I could just get a coffee or a matcha and it doesn't have to,
I felt like I was singing The Hills Are Alive and I was dancing around in fresh air. I was like, oh, this is, oh, I like this. I really like this. And I think the haircut was, my parents asked me after a couple months, like, was this too, so that you wouldn't get recognized? And I was like, no. But maybe on a subconscious level, it was the ending of a chapter. Next chapter.
And you get a bowl cut.
I got a bowl cut, yeah. I think every woman is deserves to have at least one mental breakdown haircut in her life.
I know. It's honestly, because something. It's like, is this my hair forever? And it's just like, fuck it.
I know.
Fuck it. We ride and we get a bowl cut.
It grows back. It really does. It really does.
At the end of the book, you write about choosing between two things. Buying a house, which is sort of like becoming, I think, an influencer milestone.
Yeah.
I got this because of you, my house journey. I mean, the opportunities for renovations, progress updates, stuff.
That's a content strategy in itself.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to buy a house and then make that content and then get a partnership with Lowe's.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like the furniture, like it's the most influencer-y thing kind of ever. And the same amount of money, or like you have this choice between buying the house or going to inpatient rehab, which is the opposite. There is no posting. It's can be, you know, some people could understand it to be embarrassing. It will not, you know, net you money. You will lose money on it. Talk to me about making that decision.
Yeah, well, it was a hard decision because buying a house is not only the ultimate influencer thing, but in the world that we live in, I mean, now it's becoming
America.
Less and less common for people in their 20s to buy houses, but I viewed it as such an achievement for someone from Fairfield County to buy a house doing this career. A lot of people kind of just go into, you know, finance or tech or marketing and, you know, meet their partner and save together. And I was like, wow, I might be able to buy a house at 28 without a partner.
Yeah.
And fulfill this lifelong dream I've had of buying a house and nesting and rooting somewhere and grounding in a physical space and not having to move all the time. And then when I talked about it with a friend who said the words, if you buy, I told her my predicament and she said, if you buy this house and you're going to lose it anyway. And if you don't get help for this other glaring issue in your life, which is food and eating and your body and your mental health, you're going to lose the house. Because how are you ever going to be able to keep working to pay the bills and mortgage if you're unwell? And that was, she was an older kind of person with much more wisdom, and I was like, oh, that's the wisest thing. I can hear that. I can definitely take some advice.
It's like right the now. House actually isn't an option.
Yeah, no, the house, I was like, oh, this house is not an option. If it's meant to be, it will happen later. And I had faith that it could happen later. And I was just like, you know what? I'm just gonna let it go. And also I think it was a lot of ego of wanting to like have this house and be like, look what I did. And realizing like when push comes to shove, it's oftentimes just about taking care of yourself and self-preservation and self-care.
And you write when you're talking to the woman at the clinic, she's asking you about your habits and what's going on. And you were like, yeah, well, I guess I am afraid of bleach and chemicals. I saw a video, well, you made a video about this later, that you saw a video about fluoride, you gave it up and then got all these cavities. You're afraid of bleach. Did Instagram give you that fear? Is this like the Maha eating disorder? Or, because it's sort of like, there's the food thing, but then there's also the like forever chemicals pollution aspect of it. Do you see them as related or just like, how do you see that?
Yeah, well, it was before Maha is what we know it to be now. In 2016, during the first Make America Great Again slogan campaign, Sweetgreen made a hat that said,
"Oh yeah,
Make America Healthy Again." And I don't know if they invented it or they had heard RFK say it or something, but they made all these merch hats and we all started wearing them, all the influencers. And if you had gotten, like, gifted a Sweetgreen hat.
Were you? Yes. Yeah,
so like, I was wearing it and I was like, this is so cool. I remember wearing it in Hawaii, hiking on that famous trail in Kauai, and like being so proud that people, I was like, okay, this is my identity. I'm healthy. And once you kind of scratch the surface of wellness, so some people just kind of stop at Sweetgreen and, you know, exercising 10K steps a day, but you can go deeper. You can go, oh, okay, antibiotics, those are bad. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, public schools, those are bad. Mm-hmm. Vaccinations, those are bad. Shoes, those are bad.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you're living on a field, you know, talking to no one, right. Eating, you know, organ meat. That's one extreme. The other extreme is like now like anti-MAHA, as if like packaged food is good for you.
But right, it's like the FDA said so, and like you guys are being crazy. Yeah.
But I didn't know, but it was very much like MAHA pipeline. A lot of these like stay-at-home moms who homeschooled their kids and did Reiki and had all these crazy like certifications in their bio.
Because like Moon Circle's doula is like another thing that you could go if you don't want to make a right at organ meat, you can make a left and go into like sacred healing circle.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, there were so many sacred healing circles that I went to. And some of those were in the book.
Did they heal you?
You know, I did find them really helpful. I was working with a life coach who was like a Reiki instructor too, and she did these monthly moon circles, and we did ecstatic screaming. And I found it very helpful.
I mean, that sounds awesome. Well, you know, you write about being in this rehab and being like, I was worried I was gonna, because you, it sounds like you kind of partied a lot in your early 20s. You were like, I was worried I was gonna get kind of into Molly and Coke maybe again. But there was also this food aspect, and there's also social media, which I'm addicted to. Mm-hmm. What happened were you able to organize these things and kind of reset in all the different categories?
Like, how did I heal that?
Yeah, or like, what did they tell you did they encourage you in rehab to like look at social media as its own drug, for example?
No, but the rehab was in LA, and they really blamed LA. They were like, we are in the capital of self-obsession, of health and of wellness. And they were very well-versed in when kind of a healthy diet or a health journey can become an unhealthy obsession or a fixation or OCD or whatever, or fear of, you know, I was afraid of non-organic vegetables. I was afraid of going to Ralph's, which is kind of the Wegmans of LA. Yeah. I needed to always shop at, even I thought Whole Foods was too big box. Wow. I wanted everything to be like hyper-local from a farmer that I trusted. I was afraid of chemicals. I had been sharing about those, and I think that sharing about that draws in more followers who are also like that, and then they would send me DMs, well, have you heard about PFAS, or have you heard about that period cup you're using has B-grade silicone that causes ovarian cancer? And I'm like, oh, I mean, you can just go so deep, and it can become an addiction of perfection, of like, okay, I want to be perfectly healthy. And then I was always monitoring my symptoms and obsessively scanning my body to see if I had any symptoms. I was healthy. I was diagnosed with PCOS, which is very common, but I wasn't not dealing with anything insane, and I was treating my body like a temple. Yeah, like a temple, but almost to a point where I was unhealthy.
And you're describing orthorexia. Mm-hmm. And when you were in high school, was it anorexia that you were diagnosed with?
Yes.
Yeah.
And orthorexia is not in the DSM-5. It is not recognized as an eating disorder. I'm not quite sure why, but there's a lot of talk right now from the MAHA community of like, how could you call, like, America is unhealthy. I think we can all agree that we eat a lot of processed foods and we don't move enough. And that's, I don't believe, up for debate. But a lot of people, and then there's kind of orthorexia is a growing term of like being too healthy. But I do question that now, because I think that there's nuance. It doesn't have to be either like processed foods and sitting all day, or extreme avoiding plastics. And but I think that like the rehab center I went to, they were like, oh, you have orthorexia, and any sort of health activity that you engage in is your eating disorder.
Uh-huh.
So again, kind of extreme.
Yeah.
After I dealt with orthorexia, I swung to the other side of the pendulum where I was very anti-diet and health at every size.
Right.
In that whole world. And I also
found intuitive eating.
Intuitive eating. Oh, yeah. I found that world also very judgmental and angry. And then I have landed somewhere in the middle. But yeah, I definitely, I call it orthorexia, or I also just call it like an hyperfixation on health.
Right.
Hyperfixating on myself, hyperfixating on my gut, on my digestion, on my routine. It was a lot of navel gazing.
Right, right. And, you know, it's a cliche to say that a lot of eating disorders doesn't have to do with looking good in bikini, and it has to do with control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You write about kind of where you've landed, and I want to get back there as we wrap up. Where have you landed? You're still online.
Mm-hmm.
What boundaries do you place around being online, to kind of borrow a word from maybe that world? Or how do you exist online after what it put you through?
Mm-hmm.
After what you put the internet through? Like, where have you landed
mm-hmm.
now?
Yeah. So again, like a lot of people, and my own journey has been mirrored with, you know, whether it was with food mm-hmm. or health or whatever, wellness. But after getting offline, I swung to the pendulum and I was anti-tech. I was going to as soon as I got offline, I was kind of being summoned into these large nonprofit anti-big tech events and circles, and I was like, oh my god, this seems just as extreme.
They wanted you to sort of be like Instagram ruined my life.
Yeah, yep, Instagram ruined my life, and the face of that, you know, what they were pushing, that agenda. And there was a time after.
And what organizations would that have been? Like Moms for Liberty?
No, Mothers Against Social Media.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of these stories are really sad. They're parents whose children have been victims of bullying, mm-hmm. which I very much am very engaged in, and make videos about how social media needs to, and these companies need to handle these snark pages, and Reddit needs to get itself under control. But I don't believe that, like, we can just make them go away and right. disappear. And I think that's just wasting energy. And so where I'm at a place now where I'm still learning and discovering, but it's a way of existing with it. I get a lot of questions like, how could you be writing an influencer memoir when you still use it? And especially influencing people to buy your anti-influencing memoir. Well, I don't think that you make change by disappearing and vanishing under a rock.
Right.
I think that the only way that I can make a change and affect people positively is by sharing my book, and if people feel compelled to buy it, they will. But I don't think that just never going online again and writing handwritten notes, that's not gonna, like, let's just be honest, like, it's the best way of getting messages across.
And it's not going anywhere.
It's not going
like
anywhere.
Like, as much as it's like, oh, I wish I could unplug the internet, it will right. not happen.
No, and there's so many people on Substack who are like putting together these fantasy, like, photos of people from 1999 of, like, flip phones, and being like, I want to go back to this era. And it right. reminds me of kind of like when I was growing up and my grandpa was like, back when I was a kid.
Yes.
And I was like, let's not be curmudgeons, guys. Like, we exist now with social media. How we have to figure out a way to make it work.
You call yourself on your Substack a reformed ex-wellness influencer. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious where you would put the emphasis. Is it a reformed ex-wellness influencer or a reformed ex-wellness influencer? Are you still an influencer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm still an influencer because I'm sharing.
Yeah.
And I'm promoting right now my book. I'm not sharing the same way I used to. So there's nuance there. A lot of people do not want, culture hates nuance. Like, it's like they right. want black and white. They want me to be fully offline and be like, and that's it, you know?
And did you say to yourself, like, check, like, I will post about my relationship, my family, but I won't post about what I eat or, you know, the supplements I'm taking? Like, did you decide, like, here's what's on and off limits?
I did in the beginning when I first started sharing again a couple years ago. I had like a strict and I kept it as a sign in my apartment, do not share and share. And as I've kind of slowly reemerged, I've amended it, and it just feels a lot different than it used to. I think before I was just like sharing everything without thinking, and now it's like a deep, long process before sharing.
What was on the share and don't share list?
I remember, like, after my experience sharing a relationship Online, I was like, oh, I don't ever want to do that again. I'm not going to share a relationship ever again until I have a ring on my finger. Ultimately, that has happened. And but I also, I talked to a friend who writes a beautiful Substack about love and her relationships.
What's
and
it called?
It's called Unsupervised.
Oh, cool.
And she writes very candidly. And I was like, I really admired that, how brave she was writing about her relationships and her breakups. And I was like, how do you do that? And she was like, well, I believe that if you're keeping it in, you have this kind of fear that maybe it's not going to work out. Mm. And love is risk. And luckily, I'm in a healthy, stable relationship now. But
you're a week into a fiancé-ship.
I am
an engagement, I should say, fiancé-ship. And were you in that relationship like, don't go pat? Like, did you say, like, don't look me up?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, but I was for a really long time. I think I got to a place where I have, like, I'm so neutral about the situation. I think for a while I was hiding it on dates.
Yep.
When I was still dating, I would like keep it from them for weeks, as long as I could, or I wouldn't even ever mention it. Like, I would date people for months and never mention it.
That you had an online presence? Yep. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Like a Wikipedia page. They didn't know. But with this guy, I told him right away because it had author in my bio. And my now fiance said, what are you writing a memoir about? And I said, I'm an ex-influencer. And he goes, tell me more. I'm intrigued. And he looked me up. And I'm just at such a different place with it now where I was like, cool. He's going to see what he sees and we'll go from there.
What do you hope people get out of this book? If you don't like this, I will kill myself. I will die. If you don't like this, I will die. Available everywhere books are sold.
I want people to read it and, well, I think first of all, influencers will and already have really related to it. And, you know, you obviously have related to it with the cancellation. But I think that even, I don't like saying normal people, private citizens are relating to it because we all are aware now when we post that we're being watched. Or even if you're not even posting, but you're online and you're watching this influencer buy a house. And her husband was able to quit the job and they have five beautiful kids and they just bought two new cars and they're going to Cabo in a week. And you're thinking, wow, that looks perfect. I want people to know that that's just not necessarily a facade. I don't know about that person's life, but just realize that social media and a lot of this is fake and it's a performance and it's curated. I don't think that anything online can be authentic because when we're sharing, we're automatically filtering it through our own belief system and filter systems. So it can't ever be purely. I mean, yes, it can be purely from the heart, but it's still when you're sharing. Someone recently said, but what about all these now authentic influencers who are body positive and sharing their acne story? Well, then you're locked into being the acne girl.
The acne girl, and
Like you always have to show your acne or you always have to be body positive. What if you want to go on a weight loss journey or a health journey? It doesn't really allow for multi dimensions and it's very one sided. And I hope that people kind of look at public figures differently too and humanity differently as well.
It's crazy what you wrote about how it's fake and it is fake. Mm-hmm. But and people often say, you know, the internet isn't real, but it is a place where we really spend a lot of time.
It's so funny. I wrote after my whole cancellation, I had just been reflecting on it for so many years and I have a note in my apartment that says cancellation is so weird because in some ways it affects no part of your life and it's not real, and in other ways it affects everything. That's like right. When I was canceled, I was feeling this deep dark storm, and then I walked outside and it was a blue day with chirping birds and nobody was coming for me, but people wanted to kill me online. But like, also there's people who are extremists and they will find you in person and try to kill you. So it's a very weird of like reality, and the lines are blurring. And I think that my book hopefully shares that vividly, where it's like, what is real? Like, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, last night I shared my event at the Strand. Someone, you can't say, okay, that didn't happen, that's not real, she's not actually. Of course I'm happy to share my book, but when we look at an image, it's so seductive, and we're going to come to that image with our own belief system and already our prejudices and believe what we want to believe. It can't ever be coming from an unbiased place.
I am a 15-year-old girl. Maybe I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut. And I would love to be an influencer. It looks so fun. I want to try on makeup. I want to do hauls. I want to do get readies with me. Maybe I'll even be a YouTuber like Tana Mojo. What would you say to me?
Well, I would say read this book first.
Yeah.
And then I'd also say, especially if you're like 15, go in there with your parents and or a support system, and don't do it alone. Even if you're 18 plus, of course, if you're still a legal child, you need to be monitored, yeah. I think. But if you're in your 20s even, it's not for everyone. Listen, it's very seductive and it's such a visible career. And I think that's why over half of Gen Z says that they want to be an influencer when they grow up. It's funny, now Gen Z is like already kind of in their late 20s. So yeah. It's like now it's even the younger generation. But I think we see it as such a, we're like, oh my gosh, look at this, 18-year-old kid going to free concerts and getting flown around the world because he's sharing his life on this private jet. Wow, I want to do that. Why am I working at the ice cream store? So again, using discernment here and thinking, okay, just because they're posting this doesn't mean that his life is actually like this. What is it? What does this job actually entail? It requires a lot of hard work, consistency. If you don't have the means of hiring a team yet, you're doing the ideating, the writing, right. The filming, the shooting, the editing, the presenting, and the PR and the comms. It's 15 jobs in one.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. So give it a try. And if it's not for you, I would say this is what I would tell the 15-year-old girls, is be okay with walking away.
Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, OnlyFans is a whole nother vertical of this, which is separate, but, kind of equally fascinating. Mm-hmm. We talked about like a day in the life of what, your life looked like in 2015, 2016 in LA. What about now? You're mm-hmm. back in New York. Do you wake up and, immediately check the phone, or mm-hmm. how does it work?
No, I wake up and I have coffee with my fiance. And we usually talk about our dreams and our day. We have like that moment together. He gets ready for work. And then I usually put some workout clothes on and go for a walk outside with my dog. And that's usually when I kind of check emails and potentially Instagram. But I like check it and then I'm like off. I'm not like glued like I used to be, mm-hmm. like hunched over for hours.
Yeah.
I usually like call my mom, check in with a friend. I'm just like way more grounded in reality now.
Yep.
And I go on social, I check it. Again, not so black or white. It's not like I have like rules around it. It's just like, just plays a smaller part of my life and it doesn't rule me anymore.
Do you have to say like, oh, getting a little obsessive about that post, let's rein it in here?
I think there's like times where like leading up to the book launch, I could tell my thumb kept going and opening up Instagram and checking the comments. And I'm like, oh yeah, my thumb's doing that thing again where I just like, I'm like constantly refreshing, looking for a little bit of dopamine. Okay, I'm going to put my phone down and, or just like name it and be like, oh yeah, I'm nervous about this book coming out. Like, of course I'm doing this thing.
Yeah, of course. If you don't like it, this I will die. Lee Tillman, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.